Hi, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the Ideas Salon podcast series, recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. This session, titled Free, is a powerful conversation between Leia Ippi and Monica Attard.
Hello there, everybody. Thank you for being here. It's a beautiful day in Byron today. God, it's much better than Sydney, let me tell you. My name is Monica Attard. I am currently with UTS in Sydney at the Centre for Media Transition. But prior to that, I was a journalist. In fact, I'm a recovering journalist. Spent 40 years as a journalist, primarily... Thanks. Thank you. Primarily with the ABC and a lot of that time in Russia, in what was then the Soviet Union. So as I was just saying to Leah before we started, I cannot even tell you how excited I was to read this extraordinary book. It is really something else. It's a closely observed rendition of what it is to be free, basically, which might seem at first glance, a pretty easy question to answer, what it is to be free, but it's not, actually, particularly when, as Leia Ippi has experienced, you've seen both sides of what freedom purports to be. So a little bit about Leah. Leah is a professor of political theory. She's so young. Look at her, professor of political theory at the London School of Economics. She's also Albanian-born. And Albania was, of course, the most closed of all communist societies during the decades that it was tied to the apron strings of the former Soviet Union. One thing that really struck me about reading Leah's book, other than, as I said, the sheer excitement of how accurately she's described the idiosyncrasies and the oddities of communist/socialist societies, is how utterly frustrating she must have been as a kid for her parents and for her beloved grandmother, who features prominently in this book, because she observed very closely, she internalised, she questioned, and she articulated, which must have driven your parents absolutely bonkers. But as a result of all of that is this book, where she does observe, internalise, question what it is to be free. And it's not what we in the West like to think it is, at least not for Leah. It's not just the mere right to speak your mind or to behave as you want or to go where you want. It's the ability to live in societies which have structures that allow people to thrive. So let's get stuck into it. One of the other things, Leah, that I found absolutely fascinating about this book, which I think you articulated so well from page one all the way through, and it was something that... as Moscow correspondent for the ABC, I would observe, but I never really understood, and that's the concept of biography, how important the concept of biography. So can you begin by talking to us a little bit about what that is? What is the concept of biography?
Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of concept for, first of all, thank you to all of you and to you for being here. It's the kind of thing that I never really understood as a child. It was one of these things that was so present and so pervasive that because of its presence and pervasiveness, you never really questioned. So I never really knew what a biography was. I knew that biographies were good or bad, clean or stained, more dangerous or less dangerous, but I didn't really, it was constantly used. And when I had a friend in school, someone would say, so what's their biography like? Or when my mom prepared a document for work, people would say, oh, don't forget to write a few lines on your biography. It was basically the life, the family life that follows the individual in their path. And the Albanian society that I grew up in, communist society, was divided by very sharp class lines. So you could be a working class family, or you could be an intellectual family, or you could be a family of former property owners or aristocrats who had kind of fallen. And
which is something that people don't really think is the case in communist societies, do they? They like to think of them as kind of even societies where people... are treated equally.
Because in some ways, materially, they are all equal.
Yeah.
But then capital. We all have so the wealth is not the only capital. There's also social capital, and culture also shapes who people are. And of course, that's usually filtered by the family. Mm-hmm. And so biography really captured this idea of what kind of family were you born into, and what kind of family you were born into followed you throughout your life, because it shaped what kind of opportunities you would have. So one of the things that I knew early on was that my mom was a maths teacher, but she didn't really want to be a maths teacher. She hated maths. But because of her biography, she had to study maths and not literature and not philosophy, for example. And the idea was that some degree subjects were more open to people who are trusted by the state. And so families with a good biography. And typically these were the humanities, so political sciences, social sciences. And then everything that was hard science, that could be left because there was less of an element of propaganda that could be, although there was a lot of propaganda also in maths, because you had these maths problems you probably know from the Soviet Union. Cooperatives such and such exceeded the five-year plan by this amount, and this other cooperative exceeded it by this amount. So how much more did cooperative one do more than cooperative two? So there was always an element of societal awareness that pervaded even the hard sciences. But there was a sense in which some subjects were more vulnerable to critical scrutiny by certain elements in society, and what family they came from usually determined what they would be allowed to do or not.
But Leah, your biography, your personal biography becomes very significant in your life and in the story as it unfolds in the book. And it's not just about your mum being a math teacher either. So tell us a little bit about your biography.
Well, so I actually didn't know anything about my biography until communism was over, and in a way biography didn't matter, or didn't matter in a way in which it mattered in communism. But I remember as a child that I asked my grandmother, so what's my biography like? And she said, your biography is as good as it gets. And by which she meant it's as good as it gets for people of her background and of her social class.
Yeah.
And so basically the family that I grew up in was a former dissident family, with members of the family that had been prominent in various political movements in Albania over the course of decades of coming before communism. And so one of the things about my grandmother was she always spoke French to me. And this is another mystery of my childhood. Why did my grandmother
speak
French to me?
Which you didn't much like, right?
She had no idea. I had no idea. And she wouldn't tell me why is it that she spoke French to me, other than French was a beautiful language, or that, you know, Enver Hoxha, our communist leader, had also studied in France, and that there was usually some kind of completely weird idiosyncratic reason. And the reason she spoke French to me was that she came from this aristocratic family with a background in the Ottoman Empire, and she had been a member of the Ottoman aristocracy who had come to Albania at the point in which the Ottoman Empire had collapsed in search of a state, because nation states at that point had to, you know, the nations had to find a state. And so she was a minority Albanian member who came to look for the Albanian state. But then she met my grandfather, who was a socialist and was put in prison by the communists for 15 years, who in turn was the son of a very prominent Albanian fascist politician who had been pivotal at the moment in which Albania was occupied by fascist Italy in giving the crown of Albania. And so it was the equivalent of the Vichy Quisling government. And of course, I had no idea about any of this as I was growing up.
But so it was your name, it was your surname, right?
But the surname was the same, and my father was called also the same. So my father had the same name and surname as his grandfather, and this kept coming up in history books. And whenever I asked, well, are we related? My parents would say, oh, people are allowed to have the same name and surname as someone else. What's wrong with that? And so they would usually, they wouldn't deny, but they wouldn't also say that this was my great-grandfather. And it was only when communism fell in 1990 that I discovered that actually this man that I'd been reading about, and I only remember that I was really nervous going to school on the days in which we had to study fascism, because my friends would always ask me, so are you related to this UPI politician? And I was like, not that I know. And that was a source of great anxiety that my family tried to kind of pamper over, because it wouldn't have been good in communist Albania to say, I am a descendant of this family of fascists where, of course, the fight against fascism played such an important role in the ideology of the new communist state.
And yeah. But it was a protective mechanism. They were protecting you, right? What would have happened? What could have happened?
There were So they were protecting me at many levels. So the very obvious thing, they were also protecting themselves to begin with. So if I were to go and say my parents are talking against the government, or my parents are former dissidents, or, you know, they used to be ruling elites before communism, there would be a sense that they were still remembering and perhaps regretting that they didn't live in that kind of society anymore. And so they were immediately would be singled out and restate would be reminded that they were critical. And so depending on what I said, they would, you know, they would go anything from losing their jobs to going to prison.
Yeah.
But the other, and I do remember this because at one point I had overheard that my mom's family, who were very rich property owners, had lost their properties. And I had talked to some neighbors about the fact that, you know, my mom also had properties. And these were communist neighbors, but who were trying to protect my family as well. And they said, no, you just misheard this. She was talking about not boats, but something else, because I said they were owning boats before. And so there was a whole sense in which society was filtering content for me. And what they were protecting, so was themselves. But I think they were also really protecting my ambition, because I was a very integrated child in communist Albania. Even though I had this weird family, I actually really liked my country and my state. And I felt, you know, that we were communist. Of course, there were shortages of supply of milk and things like that. And of course, you couldn't leave Albania. There were lots of scarcity. But I felt that there was a theory that somehow justified why these things were happening. And I believed in the state. And I thought society, actually, Albania was the freest state in the world. And everybody else was so nasty to us because we were the freest society in the world. And they wanted to be like us.
Yeah. And you couldn't understand as well why your parents weren't as adoring of the country's leadership as you were.
Yeah. And of course, so I grew up in school. At a nursery already before that, with this idea that there was Albania was this tiny country in Europe who was fighting all imperialisms, so not just Anglo-American imperialism but also Soviet imperialism.
Yeah.
And there was this idea that you are a small country fighting all these superpowers, defending real freedom. Mm. It was very empowering to me as a child. Mm. And so I was inspired by that model and wanted to, you know, I was very motivated. Every day I woke up thinking I need to do something to support this. And
so where do you think that came from? Where do you think, and how old were you when you first recognized that you were actually, you know, a true believer kind of thing?
I think I was a true believer until I was told that this was all rubbish. I was really, it was almost happened overnight in a way that I was in this society where I knew there was class struggle, there were capitalists. I actually felt really sorry for capitalist children outside Albania because we used to have this, so first June was Children's Day in Albania, and I remember we had a kind of comic magazine for children where first June you'd have this comic with two pages of a magazine. One page they would say first June in Albania, first June outside Albania. And in Albania you had these children carrying flowers and people with their parents were buying them ice creams. There was a long queue for the ice cream, but it was still, you know, you get the ice cream at the end of it and you just had to wait. And then on the other hand, there was this image of the capitalist with a top hat and fat capitalist with a fat child buying ice cream to their child. And right next to the ice cream shop on the floor, there were these poor children with rags and begging to have ice cream. And the child was saying, you don't have money. I have money. I can buy the ice cream. So I remember looking at these images and feeling really sorry and thinking, how can I help these children be more like me?
Yeah.
And that went on for as long as the regime lasted.
I'm just wondering whether it's still going on though for you. Is it still going on in a sense? I mean, when you think about the notion of equality, freedom, what it is to be free, yours is a kind of withering critique really of what capitalist freedom is meant to be. And I'm wondering whether those kind of childhood memories have seared into your being such that they are reflected in your academic thinking about this now.
Well, in a way, yes. It's not the same criticism, but so I am now much more aware of the constraints on freedom in communist Albania.
Yeah.
And of course, when the system fell and everything turned out to be a lie, everyone assumed that everything was a lie, including what Albania is being told about the outside world.
Yeah.
And what I discovered actually traveling and leaving Albania, so migrating to Italy in the early 90s and then moving to England and so on, was that actually not everything of that picture of the world was a lie as we thought it was in 1990. When things changed, that there was a truth to the fact that Western societies are highly unequal, highly asymmetric societies, that it's true that some children can't afford to have holidays and other children can. It's true that some families can have more opportunities than others. And so And to me, what has stayed with me because of after this moment of revelation of everything I believed in Albania was ideology and was a lie, that has made me extremely aware of the fact that there is ideology everywhere in every social system. And there are also ways of narrating the world that pamper certain inequalities and certain types of oppression and make them irrelevant in some way. And they are presented to you as though this is normal. And so in London, I live in this neighborhood, which you can turn left and go towards Knightsbridge, and where, you know, the oligarchs are Arab and Russian, and it's all extremely expensive shops, and, you know, people go and close the shop because they buy 40 pairs of shoes at once. And then you go the other way and you end up in Harsden, where if you go on the bus, there is real social deprivation. And this is in the same city.
Yeah.
And I don't want my children to normalize that. Yeah. I don't want them to think that, yes, this is a world where it's fine to go one way and end up in Harsden and go the other way and end up in Knightsbridge, and somehow this is deserved and somehow there is a story that justifies it.
I'm wondering how difficult... Talk to us about when you first moved to London. Talk to us about when you first left Albania, because I think that would be quite interesting, and what you observed and how you dealt with that.
So I left Albania for various... So first time I left Albania was actually when the borders were open. So Albania was a country where you couldn't leave because it was completely shut. Yeah. And so people, when they were tried to leave the country, they were shot at the border. And it was a country from which you couldn't emigrate. There was no freedom of exit. And then suddenly there was suddenly freedom of exit. And I lived in Durrës, which is on the Adriatic coast, where there was the largest port in the country, where the minute people were allowed to leave, they would go on these boats and hijack them and try and go to Italy. And the first time and these were thousands of people, so I remember really people literally in their kind of flip-flops and their pajamas telling the port is open, you can now go and get on a boat and go to Italy. And this was the moment at which the discourse around how you receive Albanians began to change. Mm-hmm. And actually that discourse is now still with us in Europe and Western countries more generally, I'm sure, in Australia, where the migrant went from being the member of this communist society, persecuted dissident who would be received as a hero because they were coming to tell the truth about this horrible communist world, to when that world stopped existing, being a potential criminal who was undermining your way of life and we're all trying to come and take jobs and take opportunities in the West. And that was, from Durrës, in a way, my encounter with the West happened already in my hometown because of this position of just being in this seaside city, where you could really see the different aspects of freedom of movement. But the first real travel was when my grandmother, so she was born in Salonika in the Ottoman Empire and this aristocratic family. And when the regime fell, there was a discussion that she might be able to recover all her family properties that had been left in Greece. And so we went to Greece to talk to lawyers and see if she could recover her properties. And I remember there were so many things of my first encounter with the West that seemed really weird. So one of them was the fact that in Albania, it was always dogs that followed people. And in the West, it was always people following dogs.
It's great.
The fact that there were graves in crosses. I mean, Albania was a constitutionally atheist country. And, you know, we didn't have religion, didn't grow up with religion. So this idea that there were, like, graves and churches
shrines
and mosques and all these things. And the other thing that I remember, and that really struck me for a long time, and that's also in some ways part of my thinking now, was the first time we went and we were looking at adverts, I didn't understand what an advert was because we didn't have adverts in Albania. So you would have writings on the walls that said, long live Enver Hoxha, long live proletarian revolution. And so I said to my grandmother, oh, look, they have slogans as well. And it said, like, you know, buy three, get four or something. Yeah. And my grandmother would say, no, that's just advertising. That's not the same as propaganda.
Because
I had been just told after the wall had fallen that there was propaganda in Albania and the people were brainwashed. And I remember as a child asking her, but aren't they also brainwashed if people are just selling them stuff and telling them buy this in the way in which they were telling us, like support the proletarian revolution, they're being told support whatever.
See, that's
Zara,
an example
McDonald's.
Of what I was saying earlier. She would have been a shocking child to bring up. What about this? But isn't there hypocrisy here? That's fantastic. And so, and then as an adult, your mother was actually one of the people who left Albania, right, on one of the ships and went to Italy. Mm. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so this was in 97, and this is again connected to some of these asymmetries around freedom. And so in 1997, there was a financial collapse in Albania. People had, after 1990, there was no financial sector, and so they had been told that they needed to invest and develop a financial sector, and from, you know, from one day to the other, there were all these pyramid schemes that began to emerge, who were promising a very high return for savings if you invested your savings. And of course, we didn't have savings, we kept all our savings in my grandfather's pocket. But at some point, we were told that, you know, in capitalism, people save and put the money in financial companies. And of course, these companies, they were all sprang up and were fraudulent, they were pyramid schemes. So the first people who invested would get all their money back and even more. So they'd get with this very high interest rate. And then you got to the top of the pyramid and then people lost. So 97, and this lasted for a couple of years, and 97, everybody had put everything they had in these pyramid schemes, including us. And some people, we didn't sell our house, but some people had even sold their houses and were renting so they could make more money out of the savings that they had invested. And then these pyramid schemes collapsed and there was general anarchy and state of war in Albania because everyone was fighting each other. People looted weapons from the military from the Soviet period. They got Kalashnikov, so everyone was fighting and shooting. So there was a kind of civil war type scenario. And my mother was at the beach with my brother, and at some point she saw a boat go to Italy, and she just jumped on the boat and left. And I remember this was a time that, and again, this was a kind of one of my encounters with the West, was the interpretation of this whole episode of Albanian history was there are the Gegs in the north, the Gegs in the north, and the Tosks in the south. These are different ethnic groups in Albania, and they are fighting each other. So the interpretation was ethnic interpretation because, yeah, of course, it's the Balkans. So what do people fight? They fight each other, and there is always a kind of.
But it wasn't that at all.
It was a financial collapse triggered by the ideology that had taken hold of Albania after 1990, which was what you do in capitalism was invest and save.
Yes.
And save and invest. And there's this kind of productive circle of saving and investing. And I remember when my parents were discussing whether to put the holdings in these companies, my father was saying, but I don't really understand. It seems a bit like gambling. You know, how can you put this much money and then you get much money? And my mom, who was a free market libertarian and an activist for the rights in Albania, so would say, well, why would everyone want their money back at the same time? It's like, this is how the capitalist world works. You know, well, imagine, of course, in London, it could also collapse if everyone goes to the banks and asks their money at the same time. But it doesn't happen like that because people have trust in the system.
Yeah.
And so this was the result. It was a very direct causal relation between the belief in this new world of freedom that had emerged in Albania after the fall of communism and, on the other hand, you know, what you needed to do to uphold those freedoms that triggered the collapse. And yet the interpretation from everyone who came to Albania was, this is now the north fighting the south. And my mother was from the north, my father was from the south. So it had never been an issue, the ethnic issues. But this is how most of Balkan history was actually interpreted, mm-hmm, as questions of to do with, you know, some medieval rivalry or some weird primitive fight of factions.
It was kind of like the first big fraud, wasn't it, in that part of the world, not just in Albania, but also across the former Soviet Union. The first big fraud was to convince people that they should part with their money, whatever they had, and invest in enterprises that had once belonged to the state, from which they would reap great profit and benefit at some point in the foreseeable future, and of course none of that came to pass.
Yeah, and it was a series of disillusionments on many fronts, because something similar also happened with migration and with borders. So there is this idea of, you know, there is these Western societies where everything works, they're efficient, individuals believe in themselves, they do the right thing, they have the right structures, and then all you need to do is to go there and be like them. And then, of course, the moment you can go, because in Albania you couldn't go during communism, but then when the border was open, the minute you can go, you actually not wanted. So the borders are closed.
Yeah.
It was the same thing with markets. So there is a sense in which freedom has this very asymmetric understanding, whereby it means one thing in one discourse and another thing in another discourse. And if you try and put the things together, you realize that even on the very same concept, which is freedom of movement, for example, you're free to leave, but you're not free to enter.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense, because either freedom matters or it doesn't. And, you know, the color of police uniforms and the shape of the guns, it doesn't really matter. When you're dead whether you're going or coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't matter how you died and who killed you, but the result is that you have lost your freedom.
And coming to all of these realizations, I'm assuming that this is just kind of the accumulation of life experience, your life, your growing up in Albania, which brings you to this point. But was there ever a time when you thought, wow, you know, this is the hypocrisy at the heart of the way the world is kind of ideologically divided?
I mean, there were times where I felt that, I don't know that I had the clarity then that I have now, but there were moments, for example, where I felt that there was a discourse around certain categories of people that from looked at it from Albania was very problematic. And one of them was the smuggler. We had a neighbor who was a smuggler. His job was to be a smuggler. He would smuggle people on a boat every night to Italy. And he had not always been a smuggler. And he actually didn't even look like a smuggler. He was very short. He was very thin. He actually walked on a limp. We called him Kay the Lame because he was, I'm not saying the real name. He walked on a limp. And before that, he had been working in the port making fishing nets. And suddenly, when the regime changed, the state companies had to fire people. There were shortages, they had to privatize, so he lost his job. And he lost his job, but he knew the port very well because he had been doing fishing nets in this state factory before. And so what did he do? He found a boat and he started smuggling people to Italy. He was the same person. And to me, the fact that he was suddenly, and in fact, you know, he died at sea at some point. He went to smuggle and never returned. We don't know whether he died, he disappeared. He was the father of a friend of mine. And we don't know whether, you know, how he died and he just never came back. But to me, this idea that this guy was a criminal, every time I looked at the news from Italy, where, you know, we were talking about migrants on boats and we have to fight the smugglers. And I was thinking, no, you don't have to fight the smugglers. You have to fight the conditions under which smuggling emerges. You know, it's not about the individual. It's about what is the social context in which this individual, who was a factory person working there until yesterday, has lost his job, couldn't find something else to do, and became a smuggler because he has 5 children that need to survive somehow.
Yeah. And that would have applied, though, you know, across a number of different enterprises that became necessary when the system collapsed, right?
Yeah, completely. And everyone lost their jobs, and most people had to go to Italy, and often with people who were highly qualified. So, I mean, my mother, she was a maths teacher in Albania, and when she came to Italy as a migrant, she was a cleaner for a while. And so, they had to reinvent themselves as something completely different from how they had lived in Eastern Europe, or in Albania in this case. And that was also very difficult because they were used to seeing themselves as members of a certain social group, and then they go and no one knows anything about you. And it was the same to me actually as well when I migrated. I remember it was the height of Albanian discrimination because there were lots of boats and smugglers and lots of Albanian migrants in Italy. And I remember I had gone there to study, and at some point I was helping an old lady in the train station to carry her suitcase, and she said, "Oh, signorina, it's so great there are still young people like you, because it's full of Albanians here and they steal your bags." And
wow.
And you kind of, you have to somehow, you come from this world where the world makes sense in a certain way for you, and then you're suddenly in this other world where you are seen as someone that is not who you thought you were.
Yeah. And it must be so difficult to deal with. I mean, I'm sure we've all had the experience, or many of us have had the experience where you sit in a taxi, you know, I've done it myself in Sydney, and you start talking to the driver and it turns out that they've got a Slavic kind of accent. So I naturally ask, "Where are you from?" And they say, "I'm from, you know, Ukraine," or "I'm from Russia," and "Oh, how long have you been here?" "I've been here, you know, 5-10 years and "You're driving a taxi?" "Yes, but I'm a doctor, I'm a chemist, I'm a biologist." And people are having to completely reframe their lives and their perspective. It just must be so discombobulating for them.
Yeah, and I think it's not just their life, it's their whole system of values in a way that has to be different, because you relate to the world in one way and then you relate to the world in a completely different
relationship to money, I imagine, would be very different as well. Was that your experience?
Yeah, it was really about everything. For me, the main thing was freedom, because it was such an important concept when I was growing up, and this is why the book is about freedom and it's called Free, and the central concept is how you interpret freedom in these different social systems and what one has and what counts as unfreedom in one and what counts as unfreedom in the other, and what enables you to legitimize certain unfreedoms in certain places, but then normalize them in others. And it was freedom because it was an important part in the socialist tradition. You know, we all wanted freedom, and it was all about emancipation and making freedom for everyone, creating this free world. But then it was also really important in the post-communist period, where the slogan really was freedom. Yeah. And because the idea was these societies had been very authoritarian and with this kind of top-down exercise of power, and freedom was what was lacking. And it was lacking, in a way, in the political realm. Mm. But people then assumed that the type of freedom that was required wasn't just political freedom, but also free market freedom, which in some ways actually undermines political freedom as well, but in its different way. So,
yeah. Just a reminder that, you know, we'll have time for questions. So if you're thinking of anything that you'd like to ask, keep thinking about it because we'll come to that soon. So I just wanted to take you to the top part of your epilogue. Each year I begin my Marx course at the London School of Economics by telling students that many people think of socialism as a theory of material relations, class struggle or economic justice, but that in reality something more fundamental animates it. Socialism, I tell them, is above all a theory of human freedom, of how to think about progress in history, of how we adapt to circumstances, but also try to rise above them. Its freedom is not sacrificed only when others tell us what to say, where to go, how to behave. A society that claims to enable people to realise their potential but fails to change the structures that prevent everyone from flourishing is also oppressive. Which I just thought was the most beautifully constructed paragraph of writing and really summed up the kind of the hypocrisy and the dichotomy of your world and where you came from. How does that go down with your students? Do they get it?
Yeah, I think the students certainly, by and large, even though, I mean, they're a very privileged student because LSE is a very expensive place. And
yeah.
It's not easy to be a student at the LSE. So it's not, again, it's one of these things where we've kind of normalized that at the LSE, only some people can go. And there's very few scholarships. There's very few. I wouldn't have been able to go when I was a teenager to try to decide where to go at university. I certainly wouldn't have been able to go to the LSE. So it's certainly, there is a kind of selection there as well. But I think young people are very aware of the limitations of the world and the fact that there are these, you know, structures of oppression that sometimes are vertical and sometimes are horizontal. And I think
I also wonder whether you're seeing in your students now that we're, 30 years since the collapse of Soviet communism, a recognition that there was a price to pay for that collapse.
Yeah, I mean, the real difficulty actually with Western students, so I have real difficulties with both the progressives and the non-progressives in a way, and also in Albania, in my home country, both people who are on the right and on the left. So the problem with progressive Westerners who are sympathetic to socialism and so on is that they only think about the philosophy and they only think about the ideas, and it's as though the fact that these ideas had a life in this whole part of the world and a history that was a tragic history that needs to be reckoned on is kind of, oh, you know, next time when we do it, it'll be fine, we'll work out. So there is a sense in which it's the, and again, there's a kind of paternalism with which I think the progressive left looks at, in the West, looks at experiences from the margins in its approach to history. So only the philosophy matters. The history, you know, it's just the history of this weird bunch of countries that were anyway backward and so couldn't really understand what socialism required. On the other hand, there is also the other difficulty, which is when you go to Eastern Europe and to Albania in particular, there is such hostility to ideas and philosophy because of that experience. So it's the other problem, the opposite. Only history matters and ideas just don't care anymore because we've tried them, we failed, it was terrible, it was tragic, and look at where we are now, it's all a consequence of that. So what I find really hard with, and that's part of the reason I teach socialism and Marx and the socialist tradition, is to try and strike a balance between these two things, to say, look, ideas matter, but they always have a life that is not just what the ideas intended it to be because they hit the real world. And because there are the tragedies of action that we need to reckon with. And it's only by staring and looking at this in the face and trying to understand what happened, why it happened, how it was different in different countries. I mean, socialism isn't the same thing in Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, Albania, Vietnam, Cuba. These are very, very different countries with very different experiences, just like Australia, United States, Great Britain are very different capitalist countries. And it's only if you think about their diversity that you and the diversity of their historical experiences that you will understand something about how these ideas filter in the world. On the other hand, when I talk to Albanian students, so people from the East, I try to tell them, look, there is a criticism of capitalism that comes from these texts that is important because these societies haven't changed. Just because communism collapsed in Albania, that didn't improve capitalism.
No.
In some ways, it actually made it worse because there was no alternative. And so now you can just kind of rig the system and continue, and the inequalities have gone up and injustices have actually really increased since the fall of the wall. So you need to think about how you can change these societies as well, and you need to be critical of what's going on in them and how power is exercised, and you need to call it out when you're told there is freedom of speech but actually only the rich can exercise it, and there is right to education but only some people can go to the LSE. So you need to kind of engage with the ideas and understand that there is an emancipatory power that comes from ideas that you can't completely get rid of.
So I wonder then, I mean, not wanting to kind of go against what you've just said, which is that the socialist experience was different in all of these places, but if there is a legacy from that period, positive and negative, what would you think that would be? As again, you know, taking into account that the experience was so different in various countries.
So I think actually what's positive is also negative, and what's negative is also positive. The legacy of that is that people don't believe in anything. And, you know, it's very hard to have faith once you've undergone through this systemic collapse in both of its versions. So you had socialism and it collapsed. And so that means that set of ideas was wrong and, you know, you shouldn't try again. And then you had capitalism and this form of capitalism that everyone said at some point will deliver, but actually wasn't really delivering for a lot of people and was also very tragic in its way. It went on with along with war and so on. And so that means that citizens are now highly cynical and there is no faith in a way in anything. And that's therefore also highly critical, which in some ways, you know, you can't give them bullshit. They won't take it. They'll see it.
Yeah.
And so that makes them, it's good, because I find sometimes in the West, people just buy a lot more of what they're told. And in some ways, there's this kind of criticism of coming from this position in Eastern Europe where people, they don't believe and therefore they're very critical. But because they're very critical, then they have real trouble committing to anything. So it's always this very fine line between you need to be critical, but you also have to have hope and faith and be constructive. And on the other hand, you mustn't be too optimistic and have too much faith. Otherwise, people will do what they want with you.
So I just want, when you say that, when you talk about the loss of faith, the loss in having that kind of thing to believe in, which is what you had throughout your childhood, which was what people in the Soviet Union had throughout their lives until it all, you know, magically disappeared. I wonder whether that is, and I'm sure you keep an eye on things, but I wonder whether that is in part what is behind what we see happening in modern-day Russia, you know, 2023, 2022, 2023, since the Ukraine war started, where you know, there is a belief in some parts of the country that this is a just war, that this is the right war to be fighting right now, it needs to be fought. Could that possibly account for it?
Well, I think it's more that there was a moment of kind of opening to Russia, but it was only an economic opening.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it was the free market ideology unbridled, with no effort of political integration and no effort of thinking political integration both for Russia and for the West. So the European Union made no effort to open to Russia politically and to also think about itself, including Russia, including Eastern Europe, as a project that could benefit from these experiences of these countries, rather than go there with this very top-down paternalistic idea.
Conditionality. Kind of thing.
You want to be part of the EU, there's this checklist of things that you all need to do, democratize your country, fight corruption, do this, do that, all of which was pegged to this free market model. And in the case of Russia, as I say, it was even worse because they weren't even part of the political project. So European Union was never an issue for Russia. So it was just the beneficiary of the opening up of free markets in this extremely unjust, asymmetrical, where there was a real distinction between the core and the periphery, between the cities, you know, Moscow and the kind of rural areas. And I mean, Svetlana Alexievich has written about this. I don't need to just read like secondhand time, and you really see the effects of that way of thinking on Russian society. So of course, after decades of disillusionment, that opening for many people on the ground was, it kind of came to a head. And the elites now that, you know, Russia is isolated and there is war and so on, the progressive elites have left the country, and the country is now full of just these people who are marginalized and have experienced trauma and have so they now are in need of a kind of father or leader or someone who looks after them and says, look, you know, the enemy is there. And it becomes much more vulnerable to these authoritarian transitions, but it's not disconnected to what Russia experienced before, and it's not disconnected to the model of development that the West has had and still has.
And when you look at the collapse of communism, both in you know, in 1991, both on your country and on the former Soviet Union, does that kind of begin to account for what we are seeing now, the fracturing of societies, the fracturing of economies, the disillusionment, the loss of identity?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it the loss of identity. I think it's more the loss of faith faith in liberalism, actually. And because, you know, what form does the crisis of liberalism take in a country that has also experienced the crisis of communism? Well, it takes a fascist form, because that's the only one they haven't really tried, in a way. So this is why you now see the backlash in a number of Eastern European countries, including the ones that were integrated in the European Union, so Poland and Hungary and so on. Mm. These are all projects of, I think, extreme liberalism having gone wrong and people being really frustrated and the social consequences of that coming to a head. And then, of course, you know, the far right and fascist projects are also a way of saying to people, look, I'll take care of you. If the problem is the migrants, I'll create jobs. It's usually social deprivation that is at the root of exclusion.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's, and of course, this is another category mistake and mistake in the interpretation of these conflicts where people think, oh, you know, the Hungarians are inherently racist. They're not racist. They're just, you know, nobody's racist in a society where everyone can survive and live well. So if the material conditions under which they live are such that they suffer, and if there is a narrative that makes sense of their suffering by saying, look, it's the migrants, it's the EU, it's this, it's that, then you will entrench and then you will kind of find identity politics as a way of surviving. But from this social deprivation that has roots not necessarily in identity politics itself.
So what's the solution, Leah? That's really depressing. Where does it all end?
Well, I mean, so when people ask me, I don't know if you know The Life of Brian, where he says, I'm not the Messiah. I'm just a naughty girl.
Yeah, yeah. She's a very naughty girl because she brings up all these issues. But they're really, really fascinating issues. But in some ways,
I think there is a truth to that. You know, I'm not a naughty. The solution is to being everyone needs to be a bit more naughty for themselves and discover criticism and relate to their societies in a critical way that makes it then possible for all of us to pull together resources and to come up with alternatives. I think it's wrong as well as being dangerous to just ask an intellectual or a party or a leader, okay, give us the answer. That's exactly where projects have gone wrong, when someone came and said, okay, now let me tell you how you fix this. But what we can do, all of us in our different spheres, is to cultivate the criticism and the kind of critical skills and the critical potential that makes us see every society as failed in its way. And it's only if you call out the failure that you will then be able to reconstruct.
But when you have entrenched, really, really entrenched establishments that kind of, you know, put a fetter on that kind of thinking. So you've got, for example, currently you've got NATO, which thinks in this particular way, and you've got the EU, which thinks in this particular way. And then you've got Washington, D.C. and its military industrial complex, which thinks in this particular way. Where do you see normal people fitting into influencing that?
Yeah, so this is where actually the experience of the collapse of communism might be helpful to think about.
Yeah.
Everyone thought that the Soviet Union was forever.
Yeah.
And everybody who lived under communism, my parents for one, they could not imagine that in their lifetimes they would see the end of it. You know, it was just such a solid system. It had been that they were born into it. They never traveled outside Albania. My dad was 43, 44, some of my age now, when the system collapsed. I mean, imagine even your entire life in this way of being without ever even leaving the country.
Yeah.
So you're in this system. It's completely pervasive. It's there. It's everywhere. It has the weapons. It has, you know, Soviet Union wasn't without, and generally kind of a socialist bloc wasn't without weapons. And yet there were always these pockets of dissidence. So people talked to each other. There were intellectuals. They always tried to be critical because they were so aware of ideology and propaganda.
Yeah.
They tried to think, okay, what is the state trying to make me believe? And what should I think for myself? And how can I filter this? And I sometimes think if people in the West did a little bit more of that and thought of their societies as less free than they think they are and cultivated these same critical skills of saying, look, I'm going to try and now call this out and say exactly, you know, the military-industrial complex. If there was more awareness of that, then I think then change can come from any direction and we don't know what change will come from. You know, we don't know how revolutions happen. Sometimes it's a flood. Sometimes it's a natural disaster. Sometimes it's a catastrophe. You know, when the estate generals were called before the French Revolution, nobody thought there would be a French Revolution. So history changes in ways that we can't expect and we can't predict. But what we can do is we can prepare ourselves.
Absent something like that happening, something catastrophic that kind of triggers that discussion, one thing that strikes me about what you're saying is that, you know, in Western societies, for example, there are things that you can say and things that you can't say. You can't talk. I mean, we're a bit Albanian in that way. There's some things that you can talk about and some things that you can't. And you get punished if you do talk about them. you'll get ostracised, you'll get deplatformed, you get cancelled. So I wonder what kind of fetter that places on that on that human interaction.
Yeah, and in some ways, I mean, that's in some ways that's an even worse form. Well, it's not even worse because you don't go to prison or anything like that. But the long-term damage of that is that being ostracized, it's such a subtle form of punishment that at least when you're put in prison, then the state, in some ways, the state is respecting you. It's acknowledging that you're dangerous. When you're ostracized, you're punished with irrelevance, and that makes it the spillover effect over society as a whole are much more pervasive because everyone was like, well, you know, I'm not going to bother. At least, you know, there's a kind of heroism that comes with going to prison. You can say, I was in prison, I was a dissident, I was an activist. Here, you just kind of condemn to irrelevance, and then whoever cares about their jobs, their careers, their social networks, no, I'm not going to say, why should I say? They'll make me feel like I'm stupid or it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so then the obvious, it's a bit like with the biography in Albania, then the obvious doesn't get said, which is that this is an unjust system that we live under.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the unfreedoms are really the same in both.
Well, no, I wouldn't say they're the same in both, because I think there is a difference whether it's an agent that exercises power, so like the state or the party deprives you of your freedoms, and there is then an immediate target, and you know, that's how unfreedom works in that society. And here, I think unfreedom is much more horizontal. So it's not done by someone immediately oppressing you or punishing you. It's done by the unintended consequences of all of us going about our business and doing what we do. You know, shop, go on holiday, not think too much, read certain things, not read other things. And so by the lack of, in some ways, it's an error of omission. But these omissions all also generate unfreedoms. And there are some people in the world that are taking the consequences of this kind of inaction. And I think that's where it is a type of unfreedom, but the mechanism through which that unfreedom is reproduced is very different because it's diffuse and it's global and it's not, you know, here in communist Albania, it was the Communist Party who'd send you to a certain prison. In Australia, you do something and it has repercussions in Albania and it has repercussions in Latin America and you don't know and you don't see it. It's anonymous. And because it's anonymous, it's much harder to dismantle and takes much longer and it's much more subtle in a way in which it operates.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions that they'd like to? Oh, lots of questions. Okay, let's just start here at the front briefly, and we'll keep it to questions rather than big statements.
That's okay. We weren't prepared for questions. Could you repeat the question?
The growth in that BRICS collective.
Sorry, can you say that?
I was looking into the growth of the BRICS collective. You know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and how all the countries are going to meet together, like 41 countries. To move away from the Western hegemony. And they were saying a lot of former Soviet states were also moving over there. It seemed like even though, all these things have happened, there's still the polarization and even the move away from the West. I have a good friend who is your age, who was from Albania.
We'll just wind it up. And your question is?
So my question is, do you think Albania is sort of moving towards the BRICS and the Russia away from the West?
So the question is for the broader audience, because we don't have microphones here for questions, does the entity of BRICS, which kind of is by its makeup identified as moving away from Western hegemony, does Albania have a role to play in that, and is it also moving away from Western dominance?
No, Albania is very firmly a Western ally, as in NATO, and it's a very strong strategic partner of the United States. And it has had this, I mean, it's already experimented in its history with all these other countries, you know, Soviet Union. They figured out in 1990 they need to go with the one who has most guns, and they decided that the US, you have to kind of, when you enter in the playground, you need to see who is the biggest bully here, and they're going with the biggest bully, so.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. Okay, one more question, another question. It's up the back. Sorry, and if you could be really loud.
Yeah, I've lived in Moscow, so I've seen the parallels of what you said. I'm interested in what parallels you're seeing here in the West between those attitudes from Albania in those days. For example, I mean, I'm thinking of things like progressives flirting with the far right, or the post-truth times, or how we're justifying, you know, billions of dollars on subs based on an enemy that's much manufactured by the defense industry and everything else. Mm. Where are we, what parallels are you seeing here?
I mean, I think one of the ones that the parallel that actually always strikes me is with surveillance, actually. So I think about social media as a type of surveillance. And the thing that I think about is, you know, if the GDPR could have had these mechanisms of surveillance that we have available now in the West, it would have been like so happy. And it was nowhere ever as close to that. And yet, again, it's one of these things that we just, oh, yeah, sure, it's the way the world works. They collect data. They do a few things with your data. You know, they're just surveilling you, but it's not a big deal. And so I think for that, that's one aspect of life in the West that makes me think a lot about, you know, the Soviet system is on this particular aspect of surveillance and its relationship to individual freedom, which used to be a big deal. And you think you're in a liberal society. How can this not be a very big deal as well? The way in which, you know, companies literally own you and literally tell you, you know, what to like, what to... Usually you make decisions on where to go on holiday depending on what pops up on your social media feed. And you just... The way these algorithms take you into these labyrinths. I mean, if a communist state could have done that, it would mean like its ultimate dream to have to be able to tell people, you know, I don't need to punish you, I just need to tell you where to click, and then one click after another, you go to where I want you to go.
Yeah. Okay. If there are no more questions?
I'm just wondering.
Yes, sure.
For example, Brittany.
Higgins.
Sorry.
Hmm? Which?
She's come up. Why would any woman stand up and say, I've been raped? I mean, talking about unfreedoms. And do women really have the freedom to come out publicly and say, I've been raped?
Yeah, I don't know this.
Yeah, no, so it's probably, yeah, maybe a different discussion, because I think but that's a kind of tricky one to get into here, because it's Leah doesn't come from Australia in the first place, and in the second place there's a whole kind of set of legal issues around that one, so we might table that one. But look, Leah, thank you. Before I let you go, I do want to ask you one final question. What do you think about the Albania of 2023 and where it's landed?
Well, I mean, it's still a country in transition, as they call it. It's not clear where it's transitioned into, because it used to be the case that, you know, a country in transition was a country that was transitioning to wherever other countries had already arrived.
Yeah.
The problem is that this whole category now makes no sense, because nobody knows. Everybody's in transition, and nobody really knows where they're transitioning to. And so Albania in 2023, I mean, problems of Albania during communism were only the problems of Albania, because it was so isolated. The problems of Albania in 2023 are the problems of the world. And the challenges, I think, for all of our countries are actually to be able to connect our country predicament to a global condition and to be able to find alternatives that speak to that global condition rather than just the particular countries that we live in.
Yeah. Do you recognize the country of your childhood?
Yeah, I mean, there are bits of it that I recognize and bits that are very, very different. I mean, it's very changed. It's now Albania is actually a big tourist destination, so, and everyone should go because it's a very nice, very, very nice place to go and visit. And it's. But I also worry about that, about the fact that, you know, there is a tourist boom, and I worry about the resortification of Albania, that it will. There is this hunger to open up to tourism, to have as much investment as possible, which usually goes in, you know, we need to have as many 5-star hotels, and usually these luxury developments, they trickle down very little goes on the ground. So there's a risk of creating societies that are very, again, very unequal. And not just that, but kind of really splashing wealth in their face to the poor people by saying, look, there's this resort where other people... So everything comes with its other side. It's great that we have tourism. And it's, as I say, I always urge people to go. It's really lovely. You have a great time. It's very safe. Food is very nice. There's lots of amazing sites from all layers of history, Ottoman, fascist, communist, capitalist, and so on. On the other hand, I urge people to also go as tourists responsibly.
Yeah, because you're part of the problem.
Because I worry about the implications that that model of development also will have long term.
Yeah, okay. Leah, thank you so much. Please thank Leah.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.